Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Today, an unusual focus on foreign affairs, which is something I could stand to do more of. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Vijay Prashad of Trinity College on Syria, Libya, and the Arab Spring. And then at the bottom of the hour, blogger and political scientist Sean Jacobs will put that crazy Kony video obsession into intelligent context. Before all that, some words in the news. First, in a fresh development, as this show is recorded, not as you hear it, the International Swaps and Derivatives Association has ruled that a credit event, which is a funny euphemism for default, has occurred in Greece. Greece wanted its private bondholders to agree to accept major losses on their investments in good spirits, but not all agreed. Since it was supposed to have been a voluntary arrangement, it was not supposed to be a default, but since not everyone agreed, it became one. Of course, it was always going to be voluntary in the sense that that word is used in the army, and it would have been the default in all but name anyway, but now it's one in name as well. Initial reactions in the financial markets were a shrug, but we'll have to wait until next week to see if the calmness is carried forward. And now for the major economic news of the week, the U.S. employment report for February. It was another solid affair, the third month in a row of over 200,000 job gains, with plenty of supporting details. I do have some worries about the quality of these jobs, not to mention their durability, but for now things are looking better than they did even a few months ago. The headline gain of 227,000 came with upward revisions to the previous 2 months as well. Gains were widespread throughout the economic sectors. Manufacturing extended its impressive recovery, adding a very respectable 31,000 jobs, with what the Brits call the metal-bashing industries in the lead. Mining and logging were also strong, reflecting a little-noticed and environmentally worrisome increase in domestic U.S. energy production. Factoid: North Dakota has lately been producing more oil than Ecuador, a member of OPEC. Transportation and finance were modestly in the plus column. Temp firms, bars and restaurants, and healthcare all posted strong gains. The first two are mostly tenuous and not well-paying sectors, but healthcare has both some good jobs and bad jobs mixed together. Retail and construction lost workers, among the few sectors that did. Government job losses slowed considerably. Local government was even modestly in the black. Average hourly earnings are up a very weak 0.1% for the fourth month in a row. For the year, hourly earnings are up 1.9%. They've been running between 1.8% and 2% for more than 2 years now, below the rate seen during the Great Recession and barely keeping up with inflation. This weak growth in wages suggests that low-wage jobs figure disproportionately in this recovery. The figures I've been quoting come from a monthly survey of several hundred thousand employers. The Bureau of Labor Statistics also does a simultaneous survey of about 60,000 households. It's rich with demographic detail, but the smaller sample size makes it more error-prone, especially in the short term. The establishment survey can miss new startup firms, which can be especially important in times of economic recovery. So disparities between the two surveys can be analytically interesting. This month, the household survey was considerably stronger than its establishment counterpart. Employment, by the broadest measure, rose 428,000, or 879,000 when that measure is adjusted to match the counterpart establishment survey. The unemployment rate was unchanged, but only because of a significant influx of new and returning workers to the labor market. The number of job losers was down for the month, and the number of people quitting their jobs voluntarily rose. Clearly, the public is feeling increasing confidence in the job market. Hidden unemployment measures were either flat or down. Those classed as not in the labor force but wanting a job now, a form of partial labor force withdrawal, rose only trivially, and those working part-time for economic reasons, that is, those wanting full-time work but only able to find part-time, that fell strongly. The broadest measure of unemployment, the U6 rate, which includes unwilling part-timers as well as those who've given up the job search as hopeless, fell 0.2 point to 14.9%. Although that's still tragically high, it's still this measure's lowest level since February 2009. That's 3 years ago. Only the extreme duration of unemployment categories saw an increase, those jobless for less than 5 weeks and those without work for 99 weeks or more. All the intervening intervals declined. Though down from its highs, the number of very long-term unemployed remains sticky, which is both a serious social and economic problem, as millions hang on the margins with deteriorating skills and material well-being. But the rise in the number of short-term unemployed is what you'd expect as frictional unemployment, that is, people briefly unemployed between jobs, begins to take precedence over the recessionary kind. More on the household's survey's outperformance of its establishment counterpart. On one hand, as I said, it's encouraging. It suggests that the payroll survey may be missing some business startups, as it often does early in recovery or expansion periods. But the adjusted household survey has been outperforming since 2006. It showed fewer job losses in the recession and has staged a stronger recovery over the last 2 years. While the missing startup story no doubt figures here to some degree, it's also likely that some serious structural issues are at play. A 2009 National Bureau of Economic Research working paper by Catherine Abraham, John Haltewanger, Kristen Sandusky, and James Switzer finds that workers at the demographic extremes are most likely to be categorized as employed in a household survey but missed by the establishment survey. That is, poorly educated immigrant and minority workers are more likely than average to be employed off the books, and highly educated skilled workers are more likely to be employed as independent contractors rather than full-fledged employees. Given employers' reluctance these days to make lasting commitments, it's quite likely that growth in these sorts of less-than-formal employment arrangements is an important part of the labor market recovery. These are jobs, but not stable ones with benefits. So all in all, a decent employment report, although, I should say, considerably below a historical average experience. It only looks good in relation to the deep recession and the weak recovery so far. Also, in 2010 and 2011, we saw a run of strength earlier in the year, followed by a deterioration as summer arrived. There was a similar pattern in 2004, though it did not repeat in 2005. Perhaps this pattern of growth followed by a fade is a technical quirk of seasonal adjustment, or a more structural feature of early recoveries. But maybe 2012 will be the year when recovery finally takes hold, and we can start putting all the post-crisis wobbliness behind us. Back after a musical break to talk about the Middle East. That was some of Balancing Act, a great old song by the Volcano Sons. Although I suppose the psychoanalyst could find some deep meaning for today's musical selection, it eludes me, an elusiveness that is not, of course, incompatible with the tenets of psychoanalysis. My first guest is Vijay Prashad. Vijay has one of those grand academic titles, the George and Martha Kellner Chair in South Asian History and Professor of International Studies at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. Despite that grand title, Vijay is a fine man with fine politics. He's got a book coming out in a month or two from AK Press called Arab Spring, Libyan Winter, and I'll have him back on to talk about that in detail. But with Syria all over the news, I thought this would be a good time to ask him for some clarity on that situation, as well as what's gone down in Libya since the fall of Gaddafi. Vijay Prashad. Welcome, Vijay. The Syrian situation has been a bit of a challenge to people in the Western left. We see people, on the one hand, kind of defending the Assad regime as a socialist and anti-imperialist. On the other hand, we see people cheerleading for the resistance. Help us sort all this out. How should we think about this, although it's mostly after the Syrians, but what should we think about this?
Well, you know, obviously no situation is easy to understand on its surface. You know, a reality never lines up like a geometry set. Things are going to be complicated and contradictory. Nonetheless, there are some quite simple vectors, you know, or method. There's a simple method to come at conflicts like this. The first one I think that's important is anybody on the left has to have an understanding of what it means for a state to, in a way, extremely brazenly attack people, whether they are fighting or not, but attack them in civilian areas. You know, the left has to take a position against disproportionate violence by a state against an area where there are civilians. That, it seems to me, is fairly straightforward. And by all evidence, including sections of the Syrians that are sympathetic to Bashar al-Assad, there is a recognition that the violence in Homs, in the Baba Amr district, is in a sense a sequel to the Hama violence of 1982, where several thousand people, maybe tens of thousands, were killed in an uprising by the current Assad's father. So the first thing I think is we need to have a responsible position when there is major violence against ordinary people. The second question is the characterization of both the regime and then the opposition that we have before us. So the regime, I think, has been mischaracterized by many people as a progressive or left-wing regime. Certainly, it has had its problems with the imperialist bloc, with the United States, with the Europeans, but it is by no means a progressive regime. You know, and there's several ways for us to gauge that. Well, one, its domestic policies, at least for the last 20 years, have been decidedly neoliberal. So that's something to keep in mind. Secondly, in terms of foreign policy, since the 1970s, the Baath regime in Syria has operated no longer on the side of freedom for the Palestinian people, but largely in two ways. One, to pacify the resistance in Lebanon when the Syrian army invaded in 1975. And secondly, Syria stands as a reliable border guard for Israel. It is one of the most reliable borders for the Israeli regime, particularly now that the Egyptian border is no longer to be relied upon. And finally, on the progressiveness of the regime, many of us remember that during the high point of extraordinary rendition, one of the key cases was a Syrian man, a Canadian, who was deported into Syria to be tortured. Syria had become part of the archipelago of the extraordinary rendition regime. So by no stretch of the imagination should people consider the Syrian regime to be a progressive regime or a left pole. So for these two reasons, the reason of, as it were, you know, the humanity of the left, and secondly, our own assessment of the regime of Bashar al-Assad, I don't think there's a need to line up behind him just because one of the agencies trying to perhaps overthrow him, perhaps not, is the imperialist bloc. Our enemy is not necessarily, I mean, our friend is not necessarily the enemy of our enemy. I think that is the worst way to do political calculations.
I want to return to some of these other issues, but you said that Syria has been kind of a reliable border for Israel. Could you go into more detail about that, and why do you think that is?
Well, this is an interesting question. You know, some people will say, well, no, Damascus was the home to Hamas, and Damascus was also the home to the various left-wing Palestinian factions. In fact, it is the home to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, whose leader, George Habash, lived and died in Damascus. So people will say that. Well, let's turn the lens the other way around. Today, when the Israelis look out at their borders, what they see is the Lebanese border, which is totally unsettled. You know, Lebanon and Israel have no relations with each other. That border is manned by a permanent UN force. The United Nations mans a border which is technically still at war. The border with the Palestinians, of course, is not a border because Israel is occupying Palestinian lands and mans the border all the way out to Jordan, another very tense area in one different way. Then the Egypt border, until the overthrow of the Mubarak government, was very secure. That has become slightly less secure because the sections that have won the election to the Egyptian parliament are not convinced that the 1979 Camp David accord brokered by the United States between Egypt and Israel, they don't think the accord is altogether good, despite the fact that it earns Egypt's military, particularly a large bursary from the U.S. exchequer. So the only border where there has been stability, where there has not been any threat of war, or where until very recently it was quite well guarded, was the Syrian border. And it is the case that now inside Israel, some strategic thinkers say that one reason they are a little worried about the overthrow of Bashar al-Assad is if a pro-Muslim Brotherhood government comes to power in Syria, they will feel encircled. So Assad, in that sense, has been an effective border guard for Israel.
What is Israel's interest in Syria now? What outcome would they like to see?
I mean, truthfully, it's hard to say because they are playing, I mean, it depends what you mean by Israel. You know, Israelis have a posture, a kind of madman posture in public, you know, where there's a lot of talk about bombing here and there and overthrowing this regime or that regime. By the way, if you do the calculations, Benjamin Netanyahu actually doesn't start wars, he just talks about them. It's Ariel Sharon who really had the reputation and the record of beginning wars. Most of the wars in the last 15 years were not started by Netanyahu. He is more a blustery man. But at any rate, in terms of Syria, there are two issues involved. One is Syria itself, the nature of its regime, and then secondly, Hezbollah in Lebanon. And in a way, this Bashar al-Assad regime has operated as a sort of safety valve to keep Hezbollah focused on building its infrastructure itself and not being aggressive against Israel in any way. You know, he's functioned as I said, a kind of safety valve, maybe a pressure cooker to hold the lid on Hezbollah. So the fear for the Israelis, at least those who are strategic thinkers, people that I follow, is both that there will be a hostile regime in Damascus if Assad falls, if there is no so-called strong man to take his place, and secondly, the lid is off Hezbollah, and they fear that, therefore, they cannot strategically plan what might happen on the Lebanese border.
And then what about Washington's interest?
This is complicated. I mean, in a sense, in Washington, there is a dance. You know, they have an internal dispute inside the White House over any strategic use of violence any longer. You know, the Libyan war was one thing. It appears now that the military has made it clear that the Syrian air defenses are 5 to 6 times greater than Libyan air defenses. This is not going to be a repeat of Libya. Secondly, unlike the Libyan military, the Syrian military appears to be much more professionalized. After the war in Chad, when Gaddafi's army was pretty roundly defeated by the Chadians and the French, you know, a kind of preview of the 2001 war against the 2011 war against Libya, the Libyan army was reconfigured after the Chad war. It was deeply politicized. Its morale was broken. This is not the case with the Syrian army. So there is a bloc, a realist bloc, that says we cannot afford to have there is no quick war in Syria. Meanwhile, the humanitarian interventionists led by Susan Rice at the UN, people like Samantha Power, etc., they are eager to have a repeat of Libya. In the UN Security Council, it is now clear that there will be no authorization for any kind of campaign under so-called Charter 7 of the UN Charter, against Article 7, Chapter 7 of the UN Charter. And the reason there will be no authorization is what the Russians have said is that we will not authorize any campaign under Chapter 7 in the UN Charter, which is the use of violence, unless we are allowed to go back and evaluate what happened in Libya. And NATO has made it clear they will not permit any evaluation of the NATO campaign in Libya. So, you know, you can see that in Washington there are so many interests at play, but there is no clear road to a Libyan kind of campaign in Syria.
I'm speaking with B.J. Prashad, who teaches at Trinity College. Let's talk some about Libya. First of all, there was in some ways a similar situation on the Western left of people defending Gaddafi as some sort of anti-imperialist and socialist. And then you also saw support for the rebellion there. Would your response to your analysis be similar to that of Syria in that case?
I mean, there's a little difference, Doug, because in Syria, when the Ba'ath came to power in 1963, you know, there was a military coup against a Nasserist government. There was the union of Syria with Egypt in the United Arab Republic. When the Ba'ath came in at the back of the military coup in Syria, it was always a force which was from the right. In other words, it was an Arab nationalist agenda, yes, because Ba'athism was one of the currents in Arab nationalism, but it was always a right-wing force. You know, they immediately cracked down on left-wing Nasserism, they cracked down on the Communist Party, and they sort of tethered it to the Ba'ath movement. So they were never a force of progressivism in Syria. On the contrary, in Libya, in 1969, when Gaddafi first conducted the coup, even by the reports of people in the American embassy, it was a completely popular coup. You know, one of the people in the embassy said to me that not a shot was fired in Tripoli in 1969. You know, the population was completely on the side of Gaddafi in 69. For about 12 or 13 years, there were a lot of problems with the way they governed. They'd never appreciated the importance of democratic participation. You know, one of the great failures of the one-party state kind of experiment in third-world socialism. But at any rate, for the first 12, 13 years, there was a genuine set of schemes put in place, transfer payments out of the oil exchequer, etc., which raised the well-being of the population. But by the 1980s, there was a U-turn in the Gaddafi regime. And, you know, I have documented this very closely in terms of different aspects. You know, by 1986, after the United States bombed Tripoli, there was a kind of upsurge in Tripoli among the Gaddafi elite to make a pact with the West to stop the sanctions. The sanctions had really affected the Libyan economy, and they wanted to make a rapprochement, at which point they sent out Moussa Koussa, a very important, you know, the Gaddafi's right-hand man. He went and they started spreading some blood money around. They got the case of the Lockerbie plane off the table. They got the sanctions removed, and they started privatizing very large sections of the Libyan economy. And actually the point person in Libya for this privatization program was Gaddafi's son, Saif al-Islam. In other words, the stories are slightly different, but by the time we get to 2011, essentially what you had was the carapace of a one-party state which was governing over an utterly privatized economy, and you had Gaddafi there with almost no friends. In other words, the neoliberals wanted him out because he was an embarrassment, and the people no longer supported him. Libya had also been turned into a destination point in the archipelago of extraordinary rendition, just like Syria. Gaddafi had no allies by the year 2011. And at that point, when the resistance started to Gaddafi's rule, actually, the state order virtually collapsed. I mean, you know, one-third of Libya was in the hands of the rebels in 2 weeks. It's amazing how the city of Benghazi was gone in 4 days. Nothing comparable is happening in Syria.
And what do you see happening in Libya now?
Libya now is in a very bad state. This is one of the reasons why this kind of NATO campaign is to be avoided at all costs by popular revolutions. Because what happens is it strengthens the hand, that is, external military intervention, particularly by imperialist forces, strengthens the hand of people who have no mass base. You know, their mass base was their ability to call in airstrikes. So their position was strengthened. Secondly, there was no process, political process in the middle of the war of building, you know, the understanding that when the war ends, we have to build a country again. You know, on the contrary, what the Transnational Council had done was to allow military forces to become essentially based in cities. I mean, that was the nature of the military. Obviously, they didn't conjure that up. But at no point since have they tried to fully unite the military behind one core command. And the reason they cannot do that is that the official military people are not people who have the loyalty of the troops. You know, the man who heads the military now used to live in Vienna, Virginia, in exile until the start of the rebellion, General Khalifa Haftar. And he and his sons have shown up, and they have begun to operate very much like Gaddafi and his sons. You know, so they have parachuted in. Meanwhile, the actual core of the fighters don't have the command structure in their hand. And with so many arms flying around, there is a great deal of instability in Libya on that score. Secondly, there are, by UN count, 8,500 pro-Gaddafi people in detention. And by the way, we don't have any firm numbers for how many people Gaddafi had put in his jails, but some estimates suggest it's less than 8,500. So we might now have a regime which is jailing without trial, without any judicial process, more people than were jailed under Gaddafi. They are being tortured. This is clear by Amnesty International's report, Human Rights Watch, and a recent report from the UN, which points out that the situation of, as it were, extrajudicial torture is terrible. the lead newscaster, a young woman in her 40s, just died in prison a few days ago. So the situation in Libya is quite abysmal. And the tragedy is that NATO is blocking any kind of truth and reconciliation because they don't want the, as it were, truth to be revealed about the scale of the NATO attack. And if we don't have a truth and reconciliation, there is no future for Libya as such.
There were people at the time who, like Oshkar, who called for bombing just to prevent a humanitarian disaster. Was that a mistake?
Well, you know, in my book, I go through the logic of that and look at the timing. And I go back and look at what we know now about the scale of violence. And it's fairly interesting how our numbers were not clear at the time. So the UN, the US, in open meetings, were saying things like, the press reports suggest, you know, that so many people have been killed. Or press reports suggest that we have an impending massacre. And this was the kind of tone of the UN Human Rights Council's chair, Navi Pillay. She also talked about press reports. Now, if you look at press reports at the time, what they were referring to, what they were leaning on, was a report in Al Arabiya. Al Arabiya is owned by the Hariri family in Lebanon and has a Saudi interest as well. Al Arabiya had a tweet, for instance, which said just about a week after the conflict broke out in Benghazi, that 10,000 people were dead. Now, later we find from Human Rights Watch that the numbers were in the hundreds. And we also find an interesting kind of number. When Misrata was retaken, the number that Human Rights Watch has is 238 dead and 80% men dead. Now, if there was indiscriminate bombing, I don't know how it could have been 80% men dead. What I have found from looking through the day-by-day record is that the rebels, by end February, early March, that is 2 weeks into the struggle, had taken a third of the country and were advancing on Tripoli. And what we find is that Gaddafi had an easy time retaking cities. You know, you remember the period when the war seemed to be going in a pendulum, back and forth along the Tripoli road. The rebels would advance, then they would retreat. Gaddafi had an easier time taking cities, but he couldn't hold them because they were losing the people in very large sections of the population. It is at that point when NATO intervened. So it is not clear to me from the kind of evidence we have, absent an open recording, you know, I'd like to see NATO's documentation, etc. But absent all that, the public record suggests that the rebels may have taken over the country without any NATO intervention. It may have been the case there would have been some greater loss of life among the rebels, but we will not know, we will not be able to make a calculation until we know how many people died under NATO hands. What we have is isolated NATO so-called accidents, 60 here, 55 there, etc. Since NATO is refusing to let us have a record of what transpired from their point of view, and they are not allowing any investigation on the ground, we don't know whether the balance of forces, as it were, the balance of dead bodies, favors the kind of what you might consider, it's not the right word, but there was a kind of powerful emotional surge that if we don't go in now, there will be a massive catastrophic death at the level of Srebrenica or something like that. I mean, I think there was a kind of emotional blur that didn't allow a more forensic look at the situation. And now with the emotion level lower, we're still not being able to look at the record. I find that very, very disturbing.
And finally, I do want to have you back in a couple of months when the book comes out. But we go back about a year, and it was a very hopeful moment, the outbreak of the Arab Spring. What we've just been talking about for the last 20 minutes or so has been not very hopeful. Is there anything to salvage from the experience of the last year?
Oh, yeah. Look, I'm not a pessimist about this. I don't think revolutions go in a straight line. Revolutionaries don't all come dressed in the same clothes, singing the same songs, you know, having read the same books. Revolutions happen in, you know, sometimes there are U-turns, there are complicated things that go on. So let's not be too silly about this. This is a very hopeful moment to look and see how people were able to at least begin the process of overthrowing the Ben Ali regime in Tunisia, Mubarak regime in Egypt, and Gaddafi in Libya. The question is, for us in the North Atlantic world, is will we be able to remove, you know, the hand of NATO and the powerful hand of the United States from the region and let us help the people over there incubate a new world? The greatest threat, perhaps, to the new Egypt is not going to necessarily be the Muslim Brotherhood. I think an even greater threat is the U.S. State Department and the Pentagon, who will come in and help shore up the military as a stronger institution than the parliament, because that serves American interests. So I think that is where we as progressives, as leftists in the North Atlantic world, have an enormous responsibility in helping the people of Egypt along. Not by giving them, you know, aid, assistance, and sending NGOs there, but by roping in the military interests and the geostrategic interests that are so obviously on display by the United States.
That was Vijay Prashad, who teaches South Asian History and International Studies at Trinity College in Connecticut. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back to talk Africa after a musical break.
A pity she does not exist, a shame he's not a fag. The only girl I ever loved was Andrew Bragg. There is no hope of love for me, from here on I go stag. The only girl I ever loved is Andrew Bragg. Andrew Bragg. Andrew Bragg.
A son of Andrew and Drag from a new album by Magnetic Fields, Love at the Bottom of the Sea. Though I tried to pay it little attention, I could hardly avoid the torrent of publicity for a video by a group called Invisible Children about an Ugandan religious nut and violent thug named Joseph Kony. Such is life under Facebook, where 850 million people, or about one-eighth of the world's population, shares its obsessions. To get the story behind the story, I called my friend Sean Jacobs, a professor of international affairs at the New School of Manhattan and founder of the blog Africa is a Country. The URL is a little tricky, but to find it, just Google the phrase, Africa is a Country, and it will turn up first. Sean started the blog, but he now has been joined by a host of contributors. In this interview, Sean refers to the DRC, which is the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Sean Jacobs. Welcome, Sean. I'm sure you've heard of this Kony fellow from videos of the last few days. What do you make of this internet media sensation?
I mean, the truth about this is that the Invisible Children, the people behind the video, which is a small organization out of San Diego in California, they've actually been making these Kony videos for like a couple of years. Their original film was called Invisible Children, and what they would do is they would, I think it's the 11th version of it, every time they would add new things to it. The problem was in their video, Uganda is somehow sort of frozen in time, like roughly sort of around 2000, and it's in which Kony is running around, murdering people, abducting children, and in the interim, I mean, things have changed. He's not in Uganda anymore. He's not really, he doesn't represent the same kind of threat, and in fact, it's become an excuse for the president of Uganda, Museveni, who's governed Uganda since 1986, and over whom his people are asking questions about accountability and democracy, and so this is a cover for, you know, a whole range of other issues. It's also a cover for what the U.S. is doing in that region around the war on terror. Oil's being discovered in the east of Uganda. It's about regional politics to do with the DRC, et cetera, and so on. So this video comes out, but what is so interesting about this particular moment is that in the past, when they first started, of course, there was email, you know, there were things like these sort of like, you know, proto-blogs, if you want. But now we're living in a very different time when it comes to social media. And so what they did was to use this kind of new environment, and the whole, if you watch the film, that's that's part of the message is also like the medium, you know, the sort of old McLuhan thing, which is they figured out that the world had changed and they are operating with a whole set of assumptions about how we run campaigns nowadays and who we have to appeal to. So the way we run campaigns is you get people to like something, to feel, to make some emotional, make an emotional attachment to it, but not do anything. So you appeal to young people, and the way you tell the story is it's about good and bad, and we're going after somebody bad. And when you ask them, like, well, what's the point of all of this? Well, it's to buy a bracelet, join them, you know, write an email, write a Twitter, and on some particular date we'll come to a head when all of us in the night are going to go out and put up posters. But and then the last point is, when it comes down to it, they are really just endorsing kind of the what the U.S. Army is doing in that part of the world, and what a very much a sort of undemocratic, unaccountable leader, Museveni, is doing to his people in Uganda, or what the leader of the Congo is doing in the eastern part of the Congo to his people. So it's like this, the problem is that facts don't matter anymore. It's all about emotion, and one last element of it is there's also the way that we relate to Africa. People here in North America have a long history of thinking we must save Africans, they need our help, they're always victims. They're not really people who are in it, like real historical figures. They're not real people. They're also always people that we can help. And it's easy to pull this off. And there's other, you know, there's also stuff here about Christianity. Some of the people on the board are from sort of evangelical churches. I just saw earlier somebody posted on the web a video where one of them appears at Liberty University at their convocation and basically, you know, it's part of that sort of environment too. So it's just a whole set of things came together at a time where information is moving really fast, and where real facts don't matter anymore, and it's about emotion, and it's about making people feel good, and it's also the politics of celebrity.
Well, let's take some of this piece by piece. I think a lot of Americans, older Americans, haven't thought about Uganda since the demise of Idi Amin. So give us the capsule history of what's been going on there for the last 20 or so years.
So when Amin was overthrown, he was replaced. This is sort of the end of the 1980s, so 1970s, sorry, and he was replaced by somebody called Milton Obote, who was, you know, very pro-American. And Milton Obote also turned out to be kind of a version of Amin. I mean, not in that same sort of over-the-top version, but, you know, killings, extrajudicial killings, repression, one-party state, etc. But, it's the Cold War. At that time, there was a figure called Yoweri Museveni, who led what was called the National Resistance Movement, and he fought a war against Obote's regime. He eventually defeated Obote in 1986. He came with a lot of goodwill. Like people like Mamdani and others were sort of, you know, sympathetic or provided advice, etc., to his movement. But he then started governing from that time up until now. I think late 80s onward, like in most other parts of Africa, of course, they're all, you know, like there are these sort of evangelical Christianity mixed with traditional belief systems. And there were, out of many of these movements, a sort of millenarian almost in a sense, Joseph Kony comes out of that, and particularly in the north of the country among the Asoli people. And there he committed like a reign of terror against them, like killing children, you know, abducting children into an army, etc., terrorizing the local population. So there was a real reason for the Ugandan government to go after him. What happened is that probably by like, and most people agree, even people in the U.S. government, State Department, CIA, whatever, you know, follow this stuff closely, journalists, that by 2003 he was not a factor anymore in Uganda. And so what he's done is to retreat to sort of the border regions between the Congo, the Central African Republic, and Uganda, and where he's sort of taking rents from people, you know, he's hiding away, it's sort of hit-and-run stuff, but he doesn't have that same effect. In the meantime, Ugandans are reconstructing their country. It's not perfect. And they're starting to focus on other things. So in Uganda, for example, in the last couple of years, there's been, like elsewhere in Africa, these social movements that come up, like popular movements that go to the street. They have what's called a walk to work movement, where they are protesting about the rise in, you know, gas prices or the rise in the price of public transport, and they started a walk to work campaign. This has been repressed by Museveni, but this doesn't get reported, you know, in U.S. media. At that, and also in that part where Kony is running around, that's just south of South Sudan. So, you know, there are other regional political considerations that are being taken into consideration. And as I said, also, there's also just been oil discovered in the western part of Uganda. So Uganda is kind of a one-party state, some repression, although, you know, it's like most African states, people are making money, there's a growing middle class. Also, Uganda's also dominated by other things, the attacks on gay and lesbians with the law that was going to be passed in Uganda. That's what Uganda is. But when you're watching this film, what you're kind of getting is like that there's a man called Joseph Kony, he's abducting thousands of children, Uganda's feels or looks like resembles a war zone, and this man has to be taken out, and the Ugandan army has to be armed with, you know, new technology, and the U.S. advisors who are there should be kept there. I mean, this doesn't come together for a man who has probably, most people would agree, up to something like 400 men with him at this point, that you need to have this massive campaign to take that man out. That's the context in which critics of this Invisible Children campaign read it.
What about the U.S. government's opinion of Museveni? I thought he was rather in favor in Washington, isn't he?
Well, for the U.S. government in the early 90s, the U.S. government was on this argument that there would be this new generation of African leaders that would rebuild Africa. And in, you know, shorthand, basically, it's tied into sort of neoliberal project, you know, market reform, strong governments that would ensure that your investments are safe, that kind of thing. So they had three leaders in mind, Paul Kagame in Rwanda, Meles Zenawi in Ethiopia, and Yoweri Museveni in Uganda. All three of these are leaders who up to this point already have probably been in power for like between 15 to 20 years. They win elections with 99% of the vote. As I said, there's harassment of the opposition, either imprisonment, assassination. Just, you know, it's extensive. People are being, but at the same time, they're constantly being, the message we get is that these are the people that should be in power, that is our best partner. I mean, this is the sort of language you get out of the State Department and that you get out of the sort of bilateral meetings between these various governments. And I think part of it is that Museveni plays a role for the U.S. in terms of regional politics in the Indian Ocean and in East Africa. Kagame does the same in Central Africa, and then Meles does the same in the Horn of Africa. So that for the U.S.'s attitude at the moment is to sort of say, you know, it's stable there, and they can provide him with arms and technical support under the pretext that they're trying to get rid of Kony. I mean, most people, when they announce that they're sending these 100 armed advisors to Uganda, were like, really? You know, this doesn't make sense if you're trying to get to a little ragtag army led by some crazy person.
I'm speaking with Sean Jacobs, who's a professor at the New School in Manhattan and also the founder of the Africa is a Country blog. The U.S. does have growing military interest in the area. How would a video like this fit in? I noticed some speculation on the Internet, which is, of course, a fever swamp of speculation, that this is just no innocent humanitarian video, but actually part of a larger political scheme. What do you make of that?
I wouldn't make that claim that there's a direct link between, say, the AFRICOM project, which is Africa Command, which is the way that the U.S. military is organized in Europe, in Afghanistan, Iraq, and then they would like to also develop, Africa currently falls under Europe, but they would like to have something permanent for Africa. So they have bases in Djibouti. They do, you know, joint maneuvers with Uganda, Botswana, etc., Senegal. There's, of course, the U.S., like any power, any kind of superpower, wants to, that's what they do. They have an army. They have to keep them busy. They, you know, they budget for this stuff. The video, I think, is where it comes together is like if you watch the video, they make it clear that what they would like people to do is buy this, sign up, you know, write an email or Twitter or, you know, what's the word, @ tweet some famous person to react to this. And secondly, turn up at the protest. And then at the end of the video, they say, we must provide, put pressure on our government to provide technical support to the Ugandan army to go after Kony. So they're not, you know, they're very clear they want to get, the way that they're framing it is about this one person, I mean, we murdered this one person, well, if not us, but the U.S. government will do it, or the Ugandan army will do it under the sort of supervision of the U.S. government, then this will end. I don't think at no point do they sort of explicitly say that they are part of some kind of militaristic project in Africa, and I think they're smart enough not to do that. But the problem is that for most people, they know about, you know, the African project. They know about the sort of war on terror politics. They also know that there's been historically in Africa, there've always been a relationship between missionaries. Colonialism and missionaries have always gone along. Even under Bush, the relationship between organizations working with regarding AIDS and HIV and the U.S. government, there were very close relationships about kind of the, you know, abstinence and the funding for abstinence, and at the same time, kind of you know what U.S. government wants to do in that region. So, people, it's more kind of knowing the history of these things, this is the way that people react to it. I'm not sure that there's like a one-on-one link between these people. And one last point is, in the video also, Invisible Children act like they got the U.S. government to send 100 advisors to Uganda. I mean, if you read Obama's statement, he makes mention of Human Rights Watch, and in the reporting afterwards, much of the stories was like either Human Rights Watch's influence and the influence of something like the Enough Project of John Pendergast, but it's not Invisible Children. I just think what they've done is to really do a really slick account in which they put themselves at the center of a narrative about getting rid of Joseph Kony, and as a result, it's easy to read them, you know, either as driving or having a driving seat in a kind of U.S. military project in that region.
But of course, the U.S. does have a military project in the region. What is the U.S. political and military interest in this part of the world now?
I mean, it's generally like, you know, as I said, it's around war and terror. East Africa, it is so. There's enough research, intelligence that Al Qaeda was operating, particularly in Kenya. There's been members of Al-Qaeda were from Tanzania, etc. So that's part of it. Uganda borders Sudan. So, you know, Sudan, South Sudan and its relationship with the old, if you want to call it Sudan proper, that plays into it because that regime is not seen, the northern regime is not seen as a friend of the U.S. The DRC, I mean, again, this when it comes to the DRC, I think it's less clear because of course, it's American corporations, well, you know, involved in mining. There's the extraction of coltan that relates to cell phones. And, you know, there's other minerals that are important for what people use in the fridge. There's diamonds, etc. So that goes along with the project. And, you know, of course, they talk about regional stability, pirates, all of that is part of that kind of part of that world. This is why it's odd that Kony gets suddenly all this attention, because Kony is just like he's not really that big a factor anymore in the politics of that region.
How, if at all, does this humanitarian obsession relate to the Darfur campaign?
For me, the best way to think about it is, in some way, Darfur kind of fizzled out because there had been enough critique about the methods, the framing of it, you know, in very simplistic terms, of either Darfurians are victims and the government in Khartoum is evil, but then it turns out actually the government in Khartoum sometimes collaborates with the U.S. government around intelligence and holding people without trial, etc. you know, and torturing and et cetera, and so on, and that the Darfuri, the, some of the Darfur rebels also engage in forms of terror. That, you know, Mamdani's written a book called Saviors and Survivors. They were never clear what they wanted out of Darfur. The other problem is that when you just take the Darfur example again, the U.S. government is not a signatory of the International Criminal Court, yet there's all this clamor that the Sudanese president should be taken in front of the criminal court, etc. So once, I think, once people realize that the Darfur and the Sudan thing is messier, that, you know, it has to do with other things, environmental factors, it has to do with internal politics around accountability and democracy and revolt and so on, people need another campaign. They need something here in the West that they can feel good about that. And then the way this video is made, it's about, you know, treating the viewer like a child. Once you, if you think about this like a child, good and bad, we go after somebody, we make them famous, and somehow somebody will come, they'll take him out, and then we're done with that problem. That just, it just sounds good. It sounds easy. That's the way that people talk about politics over here. And yeah, they've got a guy who is so awful that, you know, nobody is going to defend Kony. And so if you present something, even if it's full of holes, and when it turns out there's no real tangible movement here, it's not a real movement, it's unclear that, you know, even that Ugandans, when they read about this, their reaction is, actually, this guy's not a factor anymore. What you're doing is you're creating problems for that local population, et cetera, and so on. They don't want to hear that, because what we know here is that we help people. You know, I think it just continues this kind of an updated version of sort of, you know, if you want the white man's burden. I mean, not everybody's white in these campaigns anymore, but it's that same kind of thing. It's a tendency here in the West to think about other places and thinking about solving those places in very simplistic terms.
How does our Christian right figure into this sort of thing?
I mean, this is, I think, an interesting part of this Invisible Children thing that has not been written about, and I've seen a couple of few emails going around it about, you know, there are Christian right people sitting on their board, that they come out of, so that's the tradition they come out of, which is the sort of, you know, we help people. There's lots of missionary activity in Uganda, in East Africa in particular, like plane loads of people going out there to build schools, and they emphasize this also in the video. And you will notice that Rick Warren of Saddleback Church was quick to retweet. Tons of these sort of far-right Christians were quickly on it. I mean, Rush Limbaugh, he accused Obama of being in bed with Kony, but this was like about a month ago. But other than that, most right-wingers are on board because, you know, this makes sense in that we this fits into this narrative, because my hunch is, if you just look at the board of Invisible Children, that they very much tied into those politics.
And then finally, certainly it's hard enough to get good information about our own country, but when it comes to Africa, it's especially difficult to get decent information. So how could listeners find out what's really going on in any kind of depth and complexity? You can start by plugging your own work if you like.
No, I run a blog which grew out of my frustration with the kind of ahistorical, decontextualized reporting in Western media, mainstream Western media, in which Africans are victims mostly, or the emphasis is on children or whites who are saving them. Actually, you know, if you spend enough time, whether it's on, you know, on the very same social media like Twitter and Facebook, etc., you can search out and you can find this kind of information. Like, one of the most interesting aspects of, in the same way that Invisible Children is growing, up to like 50 million people are watching it on YouTube, etc., and so on, the, you know, this Kony 2012 video, there's a Ugandan journalist who yesterday made a little video where she reacted directly to them. Her name is Rosebell. And today, today, which is Friday, she got up to about, she's already, I think, up to like 15 to 20,000. So hopefully people have been retweeting it, reading it. You know, nobody's saying there aren't war or there's not famine or there aren't, you know, governments aren't accountable. Africans are no different from any other people. African leaders are no different. They also would like to get away with things. But Africans are also active citizens. You know, Africans produce media. I think that they're, if people visit sites like, as I said, you know, my own site, Africa the Country, they do something like allafrica.com. There are other outlets like Al Jazeera maintains a really good, Al Jazeera English has a great coverage of the African continent that goes beyond this kind of, you know, sensationalist reporting. I mean, BBC World Service has a great Africa page. RFE, the French radio network, Radio Netherlands International. And then there's lots of great media coming out of those countries, you know, whether you, and including commercial media in Kenya and Uganda, The Monitor in Kenya, The Nation, and there's Amandla out of South Africa. So there are definitely, you know, other media that you can consult to get behind or beyond this kind of oversimplistic good and evil Africans as sort of children, or, you know, infantilizing Africans and not treating them as adults and as real agents.
I was Sean Jacobs, a professor of international affairs at the New School in Manhattan and founder of the blog Africa is a Country. To find it, Google the phrase Africa is a Country. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Crush from the Sleigh Bells' new album, Reign of Terror. There is no deep meaning, political or otherwise, to this song or its selection. Till next week, bye.